RadioInfluence.com.
Welcome to the January 23rd episode of the MMA Report Podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Foyt, and come here on this week's edition of the podcast. We're going to take a look back at what happened this past Saturday night at UFC Brooklyn, the UFC debut on ESPN+. Then we're going to get into this weekend's Bellator 214, along with previewing the fight card. You're going to hear my conversations with Aaron Pico, Juan Archuleta, and Ricky Bandejas, who all will be on that main card of Bellator 214. Daniel, how you doing, man?
Jason, I'm doing quite well. We are coming off the heels of a huge sports weekend. Both of you are an MMA fan. We had the ESPN Plus debut. We had the first ever ESPN fight. We will never forget it. Corey Sandhagen and Mario Bautista. It was magical. The Manny Pacquiao fight, Jason, that was a thing. We're going to get Pacquiao Mayweather again, I'm pretty sure. And of course, by God, were you enjoying some buffalo wings while you're watching NFL on Sunday?
Oh, wait, what did me and my wife have on Sunday? I can't even remember. Oh, I got some calzone from a place that's right by my house. I got off the airplane about 1:30, went and got a calzone, and I just kind of sat there and two great games. You know, obviously there's the officiating thing, but overall it was two great games. I'll tell you this: my wife is not a football fan, Daniel, but she was hooked on the Patriots and Chiefs games because she was kind of rooting against one team, so.
Yeah, well, look, the calzone, the old pizza taco. That sounds great, Jason. I was rooting for the Patriots to lose as well. You mentioned you were coming back on a plane. You were at Valor, right? How did that go?
Yeah, I was up in Knoxville for Valor Fighting Challenge. That was good. You know, it's always good to kind of see a bunch of, local MMA. They had 17 fights, two amateur fights, and 15 pro fights. They were supposed to have a amateur fight between two YouTubers. One of the YouTubers basically doesn't show up, essentially. Apparently, kind of using a fake name in terms of some of his paperwork. So the commission's like, that ain't happening. But one of the YouTubers did show up and still kind of talked to people. But no, it was good. It was good. It was got a chance to talk to Eric Turner. Of course, runs Knoxville Mixed Martial Arts. He's the owner of Valor Fighting Challenge, also most notably known as a coach of Ovince St. Preux. So I had a good conversation with him. And it was a good time. Wasn't too cold. My first time in Knoxville, I will tell you, Saturday before the fights, I found like this little chicken spot. Had chicken and waffles and this southern quesadilla. Oh, so if I ever go back to Knoxville, I'm going back to that place. It was so good.
Oh, that sounds good, man. I've heard so many things about the Nashville hot chicken that they got going on there. I just know food in Nashville is absolutely good. Or is it Knoxville?
I've been to Nashville a couple times. That's a good spot. I'm actually, me and my buddies actually are thinking about maybe going up to the fight night card there. We've been kind of talking about going making like a guy's weekend, go to a UFC fight. So Nashville is one of the spots. I've always had a good time in Nashville. But I did see the main event and co-main event of UFC Brooklyn Live. The rest of the card, watch after the fact. I will say this, very easy to go back and watch the fact when you have that ESPN Plus subscription. I did see people kind of noting about some buffering issues, whatnot. But I will say this, for the main event, co-main event, no issues. Had it right on my phone on the ESPN app. Yeah, absolutely zero issues with the stream quality of it. Obviously, the main event did not go the way that we thought with Henry Cejudo winning in 32 seconds. One of my kind of, we can talk about the stoppage here in a second. But one of my general thoughts is Dana White still does not want to give the answer to the question of whether the flyweight division is going away or not, which I think we pretty much know the answer to the question anyway. Dana just doesn't want to tell us the answer. But after seeing what we have seen now with Henry Cejudo in his last two fights, beating arguably, one of the greatest fighters in all time in Demetrius Johnson, going out there, and beating TJ Dillashaw, the champion of weight class above him, how do you not give Henry Cejudo this opportunity to prove whether or not he can be a star and get people interested in the 125-pound division?
it's kind of a great story. And I also wonder if it's a story the UFC wants to tell, because on social media, and it's not like Dana White is talking to the UFC Twitter guy, but they released a promo about like Joseph Benavidez after his win over Dustin Ortiz, almost begging for them to keep the division alive. And I'm like, this is kind of a good story to tell. A rally the troops to save the flyweight class is like a story that I think would really resonate with people. I feel like the next fight to do is Cejudo versus Benavidez, but I think the ball should be in Henry Cejudo's court in terms of what he does next. It's hard to, you know, the win over TJ Dillashaw honestly really devalues the bantamweight title. It's hard, I think, to turn around with TJ Dillashaw and have him fight anybody other than Henry Cejudo, because it feels like the best 135-pounder is probably Henry Cejudo. So that's a tough one. But after watching the UFC card, Jason, the fight I want to see is Benavidez versus Cejudo at 125.
You know, one of the things we heard Henry talk about last week was that this was about saving the 125-pound division, that this fight was for the flyweights. You know, even that pre-fight press conference, he's trying to make a deal with Dana, and Dana doesn't want to answer the question about whether you're keeping around, which at that point, it's just like, Dana, just say it. You don't want to be in the flyweight business, and you are using TJ Dillashaw to end this, but it didn't go the way you wanted. And, you know, to me, and I totally agree with you, so who, if you want to keep the 125-pound division alive, and Henry Cejudo can play a huge role in this, is go ahead, let's put Cejudo, Benavidez, and I'm going to one-up it, Daniel. Put the thing as a main event of a pay-per-view, and then that gives the UFC an out. If they want to get rid of the division, they can sit there and say, hey, this thing only sold 150,000 buys. It's not a draw. We're ending it. To me, I think it's good on both sides. And I look at Henry Cejudo, and you know, I think we're starting to kind of see the personality of Henry a little bit. Like, give this guy an opportunity to prove if he can make 125 pounds a division that people will go out of their way to watch.
Look, I think, yeah, Henry Cejudo is just, he's going to be the breakout star this year if he continues to win, which he probably will. The breakout superstar, because the UFC hasn't really made a superstar probably since Conor. And Henry, based on what he did in the cage and what he's done in the cage in his last two fights, and honestly, he was the one fighter on ESPN that really impressed me the most in terms of like sound bites. I thought he had the most traction. When he did that ESPN car wash, he was the guy I saw on Twitter the most, you know, battling with Stephen A. Smith, etc. So I think he understands the game. And he's, you know, understands the fight game too, based on what we saw, the head kick and the pummel punches on the bantamweight champion. So I think this might be the year, a big year for Henry Cejudo. And again, people love stories. I mean, the fight game, promoting it, so much of it is promoting stories, storytelling, and the story you can tell, this guy who's an incredible talent, single-handedly saving a weight class, is one hell of a story to tell, even though it's real, and even though it's clear the UFC wants to get out of the flyweight business. I mean, the awkward moment is, you know, the UFC calling back all these flyweights they left hanging. You know, it's like a girl. You treated like a random hookup, and then all of a sudden she becomes, you know, the president of the United States, and you call him back, and you're like, baby, I love you. It's like there's a lot of flyweights Dana White's going to have to be calling saying he still loves them. And I think that's probably an awkward moment too, because like at this point, Jason, how many flyweights are in the UFC currently?
Here's a question I would have with you on that one. What flyweights are you going to sit there and call back and say, please come back?
Demetrius Johnson. Demetrius Johnson would be the one I would call back.
Okay, also, but you more interested in watching a Demetrius Johnson fight or Ben Askren? Because here's the part I think people have not grasped on, potentially what would happen if you got rid of 125. Let's say you have 20 fighters or 25 fighters at 125 pounds. Well, you've got to sign 25 fighters to replace those guys, and they're going to be at higher weight classes, which people tend to watch more.
You're right. But I think at the end of the day, it's not going to be a dramatic impact if those 25 higher weight guys are going to sign. I really don't think so. And I just think this is a star-driven business. I think people more than likely will watch light heavyweights and middleweights than flyweights for sure. But when you have somebody like Henry Cejudo, who's imminently more valuable than, I don't know, at this point. At this point, Henry Cejudo to me is a more marketable fighter than Robert Whittaker at middleweight. I mean, with Robert Whittaker, the cool thing is you can bring him international and do real well there. But when you have something real precious like Henry Cejudo at flyweight, I think you don't mess things. You don't mess with it right now. You really don't. You really got to value things like that.
And when you look at, if you go to the UFC rankings, there are 15 flyweights that are ranked. I mean, you know, you look at guys that they've released. You know, Shorty Torres was one of them, which, I mean, look, I think that there was, I don't know how much the UFC wanted to be in the Shorty Torres business from the start, just because of kind of how he, the social media posts he did, just trying to get in the UFC. Because one of the things Mick Maynard has publicly said on his Facebook is, don't sit there and tag me every damn day and expect I'm going to sign you, which that is something that Shorty Torres did. He would tag Dana, Sean Shelby, Mick Maynard, UFC every day. So I don't know how much they necessarily wanted to be in the Shorty Torres business. You know, you had, God, I'm trying to think their guy, Jared Brooks was one guy they released. I mean, I think in terms of the guys they got rid of, I don't know if there's, you know, there's like, oh, we got to bring those guys back. But I get what you're saying. Let's get to the stoppage of the fight. I don't have an issue with it.
Me neither. Absolutely not. This was going to end in 10 more seconds if it wasn't stopped at that point. That's the way I look at what happened there.
I watched the post-fight press conference with Dana. And you had a great line before we started recording. Dana being Dana. Because that was exactly what that press conference was. Like, as I sat there, I was literally in the Knoxville airport watching this thing. And I'm going, what did he want? TJ Dillashaw to be knocked out cold and be completely asleep, and now we're going, oh my God, Kevin McDonald way too long to stop this fight. Like, I don't know if there would have been, you know, and how much, and God, and maybe it's wrong of me to think this, Daniel, but how much of that was Dane was just pissed that Henry Cejudo won?
Oh, 100%. There's not even a possibility of anything else. Dana says stupid things. Dana says emotional things. Dana lives in an alternate reality half of the time. He really does, you know. It's sad and it's absurd, but it's also kind of why I like Dana. He's kind of crazy. This was a fine stoppage. It was a bad reaction by Dana. I can understand why TJ feels the way he did, because at the end of the day, his dream of being a double champion is over. You know, it was stopped, and maybe he believes he could have rallied back and done a Rocky Balboa comeback. But I mean, this would have just been like Rocky, whatever, the one where Apollo died or whatever. Like, that's what it would have been, you know, if the fight continued. It was not looking good there. And it was relatively close in that we have seen – I mean, look, early in the card, we did see Glover Teixeira nearly get put away with some elbows, and he rallied back and got the win. We definitely did see that, but based on what we saw, I thought it was a proper stoppage. I get why Dillashaw was upset, because that's his own perspective, and he's obviously self-interested. But watching those first 32 seconds, the story was pretty clear. Henry Cejudo was the better guy that night.
No question. I mean, look, you know, I mean, what, do you want to give him 5 more seconds to just keep landing strike? Let's note, he landed 18 of his 23 strikes, where TJ Dillashaw, 1 of 3, you know, Henry to his credit, with one knockdown where he just essentially face-planted. You know, TJ Dillashaw, I have no problems with Kevin's stoppage that fight. I do find it just absolutely comical that Dana White has no idea how many fights that Kevin McDonald has worked for the UFC. I mean, it's like, you have to, like, you know, he's, you know, oh, these guys shouldn't be in title fights. Like, FYI, Dana, he was the referee of Cormier Ozdemir last year. I guess you forget that little note. It's Dana being Dana. Like, it's he has this, oh, you know, here I'm coming, come out, I'm going to bash this referee. I mean, like Dana, have the conversation with Mark Ratner before you go to that stage and make sure you got your facts straight.
I know. It's not like he's not at the events watching the things happen in the cage, you know, not talking to the refs. I'm assuming that's just the thing he does. It's weird.
I think it's in Dana's weird ideal world, is that Herb Dean would be refereeing every fight.
Yeah, and Steve Mazzagatti would be an usher. That would be his ideal world.
Could you imagine if, like, it just Steve Mazzagatti show up as a referee for, like, UFC 235? You think Dana would just lose his goddamn mind?
Oh my God, yeah.
Could you imagine if Nevada just wanted to screw it to Dana? Hey, by the way, we're making an official our referee for Jones, Anthony Smith, and Steve Mazzagatti.
And don't worry, for the co-main event, we'll bring out Kim Winslow.
I'm pretty sure they're both still licensed as referees in Nevada. They'll never work a UFC event. There is no way the commission would ever let them work it.
Yeah. I do wonder what they're up to now.
By the way, there is a Nevada commission hearing next Tuesday.
What's on the docket?
Oh, we got a lot on the docket. Jones is supposed to be on the docket. Khabib's supposed to be on the docket. Conor McGregor's supposed to be on the docket. Dylan Danis is supposed to be on the docket. Everyone related to that 229 debacle is on the docket. Oh, that's going to be an interesting... I have a feeling next Wednesday when we do this podcast, it's going to be a big topic of conversation.
Well, I'm excited.
Oh, I think Nevada's going to try to financially hammer Conor and Khabib.
Hey, man, when you can get money, you get money. Although, isn't it weird? Like, should Nevada financially do that? Like, isn't that New York's call? Or, I don't understand, Jason. Like if the thing happens in New York, why does Nevada...
No. You got to remember, Conor Khabib happened in Vegas.
Oh, shoot. I'm an idiot. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, now I understand. Yeah, I don't know why I thought that... In my brain, the bus thing happened.
Daniel, get ready next Tuesday at 11 a.m. Central Time for your Twitter timeline to be buzzing with every MMA reporter basically giving you a play-by-play of what's going on.
How much money do you think, realistically, Nevada would go after?
$1 million each from Conor and Khabib.
Damn.
I'm telling you, I look at that situation. We'll get back to UFC Brooklyn in a second. I look at that situation, and it's hard for me to not sit there and wonder, is this a cash grab by the commission?
Well, so where does the $1 million go?
Supposedly go to charities.
Where do you think it goes?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, look, I think there is issues with Nevada commission. I mean, there's a lot of things I've heard recently. it's like I look at the Jones situation. Like, okay, how can you punish him? First off, you can't punish him financially because he didn't make money in Nevada for that fight. Are they going to, I mean, and the fact that the UFC has already booked him for Nevada in March, there's no goddamn way he's getting suspended. No way. Mm-hmm. I would be floored if Nevada does not approve his license for March, what's that, March 2nd? March 9th?
Yeah.
Where are the days of that fight?
Absolutely not.
You know, the fact that UFC has already publicly put it out there tells you they have had a conversation with Bob Bennett and Anthony Marnell saying, are you guys going to license him or what? Because if they were not going to license him, that pay-per-view would be in California.
Yeah.
And there's still a lot of questions I have about Nevada of fact of how, what's the right word to say here? How transparent were they with Andy Foster and the California Commission on what they knew about John Jones and his drug test in the month of December?
And they probably weren't at all.
That's my big question. How transparent were they? Did Andy Foster have every detail? And I have my doubts that he did.
Yeah, but he did talk to that one doctor in Utah, so.
Well, I mean, so, look, it's just that whole situation. Like,
we're all uneducated idiots.
Dude, that
doctor in Utah told us, like, it's so stupid.
That whole situation, like, I feel like everyone was played in that one.
Yeah, because one doctor in Utah told us if he could figure out the day it was ingested or whatever.
Dude, like,
get out of here.
I don't know, man.
He felt a lot like Greg Hardy after he lost that fight.
By the way, kind of correlate, John Jones. Daniel Cormier's comment at the end of the Hardy fight was spot on. That is the absolute last thing Greg Hardy needed. This is my general thought about the end of that fight. The inexperience of Greg Hardy showed there in terms of a lot of experienced fighters kind of know how to feel, you know, when they know it. I mean, to me, I mean, I saw people questioning the maturity, calling, you know, Greg Hardy a cheater. I do not think Greg Hardy is a cheater. I just think that was an inexperience of kind of not being able to feel when that knee, that one knee that was on the ground that was going to come up. And I was sitting in my hotel bar and someone had it on the iPad. And right when that happened, I said, oh, Alan Crowder's not going to fight anymore. He's going to get a DQ win. You knew it was coming. And when you hear Dan Mergulata say, hey, if Alan can't continue, this is a DQ, like, he just gave Alan Crowder the out.
And I tell you what, I don't think that's the worst move by the referee, because I will say it would have been bad if after that illegal knee, Crowder, like, fights again and then he gets knocked out, like, 15 seconds later. Like, that is an interesting deal, because it's like the fight should just straight up end after that moment, you know? I mean, that was egregious, and it was a perfect opportunity for Crowder to take the way out, but man, dude, that knee did a lot of damage regardless. Like,
no, yeah, I mean, look,
it was so blatant.
Yeah, it's easy for me to sit here and say, hey, maybe he could continue, maybe not, but right, it's because I have seen that scenario play out so many times in my 9 years of covering this sport where, you've just seen that where fighters, you know, just doesn't continue. They get the win. You know, one of the things I think you see with Greg Hardy is, you know, and I think we talked about it last week is, hey, what happens if he doesn't get that knockout, you know, in the first 2 minutes? And I think you do see the kind of what the current skill set of Greg Hardy is, what happens, and we saw it when all of a sudden you can't land that big bomb that ends the fight. I mean, it was kind of funny in the second round where Alan Crowder is basically taunting him to throw something at him. But I think overall the synopsis of this fight was, when you think UFC quality fight, that's not it. That looked like a fight we would see on a non-UFC / Bellator show.
Yeah, Greg Hardy shouldn't be in the UFC. I mean, simply put, maybe he has potential, but he shouldn't be in the UFC.
He was rushed there.
Yeah, and you know what's the most saddest thing? I'm just going to put this out there. If Greg Hardy was just an NFL player and had not committed any off-field transgressions, he would not have been put in this spot. I think because he did, he became such a name that's the reason why he was in the co-main event.
Oh, no doubt. Oh,
which is like a really weird way of looking at it. It makes you feel uncomfortable, really uncomfortable. It's awful. It's bad, man. And it's like, it's hard to do the redemptive arc, even though you want to do it with any human being. But man, it's just, it was rough stuff, bro. And you'll get another shot, but Jesus, it was just hard to tell the Rachel Ostovich story. And man, they went all in on it. I mean, that to me, that was a story that they wanted to tell with the production about all the adversity he faced and she faced, and then go in the co-main event and tell the Greg Hardy story, and the only way you told it was just calling him a much maligned Greg Hardy. It was rough, man, and you know, Alan Crowder's not a very, you know, he's not a top tier heavyweight. I would say.
No, I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, you can't fault first round management for getting Hardy into a payday like that. You can't blame him for that at all. I think it really makes you wonder what are the people at American Top Team, would they kind of think about that opportunity? Were they kind of sitting there going, hey, let's develop this guy a little more? You can't, I mean, and look, he's going to get another fight in the UFC, folks. Plain and simple. You may not like it. It's going to happen. And he's probably going to get more than, you know, I would venture to say he's going to get at least two more fights. Unless even if he loses next fight, I think he gets at least two more.
Yeah, probably two more, even if he loses, unless he loses really badly. Like, if he fights a bad guy and the bad guy knocks him out in the first round, I think that could be a wrap, just because he might say it's a wrap.
Yeah, I mean, look, you got if you're the UFC, and we're going to talk a little bit about this later on the show about Jake Hager, you got to find a fight that you truly believe he's going to win. And I think they truly believe that Alan Crowder, he was going to beat Alan Crowder. There's not a doubt in my mind. But I just think at the end of the day, you look at Greg Hardy and, you know, he's going to learn from this experience. It's inexperience. I think that, you know, one of the things I saw how people reacted is, you know, look, in just in terms of just, let's just talk about the fighting aspect of Greg Hardy. Let's not, we've talked enough about his past. Talk about what we saw on Saturday night and some of the reactions I saw from people. I wonder if the roles were reversed and Alan Crowder was the 3-0 fighter, would people be calling him an immature fighter for landing an illegal knee and calling him a cheater? And I think the answer is no.
No, absolutely not. I think people would definitely read into what has happened inside the cage with this pass, which I think is a difficult thing to do. I mean, I just think what happens in the cage is such an independent thing, and inexperience is an interesting way to lay it out. And it could also be emotions with inexperience. It's like Crowder was talking some trash there. He really was in the cage, and I think maybe that could have Greg Hardy's like, I just want to hit this guy in the head. And he was inexperienced and didn't was control of his emotions and wasn't really thinking things out when he threw that knee. Because the one thing with the knee is it's not like it was a situation where Crowder – it was a close situation watching it. It wasn't like Crowder was stepping down or stepping up. It was pretty down, and he just locked and loaded. So watching this fight, you know, Greg Hardy's got power in his hands. If he fights a heavyweight with a weak chin, he's going to put him away. Currently, there isn't a whole lot else to take away from his game. It's like he's like a dollar store Shane Carwin at this point in terms of he's got great power, but once it gets past 3 minutes, it's not good. And you know, if you're the UFC, match him up with a guy with a similar amount of fights to Greg Hardy that's obviously worse, and let him get some wins if you want to build around him. Personally, I wouldn't build around him, but they want to be in the Greg Hardy business, and I mean, he's not a very good fighter currently. He might become a good one. He has some potential. But this fight against Alan Crowder, I think a heavyweight with immense potential would have put away Crowder.
No. I totally agree with you. You know, you mentioned about Raisel Ostojic a little while ago. And, you know, look, that fight surprised me. I thought we saw the strength advantage that Rachel had, particularly in that first round where, you know, she was really just able to just very much control Paige VanZant on the ground. But Paige ends up getting the win in the second round. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was Paige VanZant and her ceiling at 125 pounds. And I put this on social media, kind of ask what people you know, thought about what her ceiling was. And you know, and we're going to talk about it here in a second. And one of the things, you know, George says she was clearly losing the fight before she got the W. She needs a lot of work, but hats off to her for not giving up. Joe says she has peaked. Mike says Roxanne, and, you know, mentioning about who she could potentially beat in the top 10. Mike saying Roxanne and Lauren Murphy, maybe, but that's it. And when I look at that top 10, there's not many people I think Paige VanZant can. She might have, you know, and look, and maybe we see kind of the evolution of her game now, training full time up in Portland at Gracie Baja. But if I just look at the top 15, could you name four fighters that you would say you would pick Paige VanZant to beat that person? We'll go 15-1. You know, I'll just list them off right here from the start. Montana De La Rosa, Andrea Lee, Mara Barella, Ashley Evans-Smith, Jennifer Maia, Joanne Calderwood, Jessica Rose Clark, Lauren Murphy, Roxanne Modafari, Liz Carmouche, Alexis Davis, Ioana Andrzejczyk, Kaitlyn Kukjin, Sahara Eubanks, and Jessica Ai. There's no one in that top six that I would pick her against.
Maybe Sahara Eubanks.
I'll tell you this, like when I looked at that top 10 and I really started looking 6 through 10, I looked at what I thought were the worst possible matchup for her, 6 through 10, and that is Liz Carmouche. That is the absolute worst. If Rachel Ostojic was able to take her down with ease, what do you think Liz Carmouche is going to do?
Yeah, you're right. That was a glaring hole, and she realized it after the fight was over that it was, but I mean, the glaring hole was she went out against Rachel Ostojic, and she was on track to lose that fight after the first round. She got straight up out wrestled, so the game plan is not too difficult to foresee. Carmouche would definitely wreck her. I mean, for Paige VanZant, tomorrow she's not going to have much success against many people on this top 15 for sure. But fortunately, this flyweight top 15 is absolutely probably the weakest top 15 among any weight class other than women's featherweight. It's the easiest one to climb up, the easiest one to compete against.
You act like there is a UFC women's featherweight ranking.
I know. Is there one?
No, there's not.
It's completely good. They just deleted it.
It's Amanda Nunes champion, Chris Cyborg, Megan Anderson.
Yeah. So it's better than that one. Look, this isn't a murderer's row. Joanne Calderwood looks solid. Watching Joanne Calderwood's fight, watching Paige VanZant's fight, I think Calderwood beats Paige VanZant. There's a reason why Paige VanZant's not a part of the top 15 currently. But she is a fighter who I could talk myself into over time rising up the ranks if she dedicates herself. And it kind of sounds like that's what she wants to do. As soon as John Anik hopped in the cage, he was so defensive. It was like, so Paige, to all the doubters saying you're going to leave the UFC, you're here for a long haul, huh? She's like, I haven't made that decision yet. But it was
is so much money she can make away from fighting. We both know it.
Yeah, totally.
Look, there's no doubt she clearly loves mixed martial arts. There's no doubt about it. But you know there are people around her that are probably looking at her going, Paige, you can make much more money outside of MMA and not have to go through the wear and tear of training for a fight.
Yeah. The one thing I love about Paige, and you've seen in so many fights, and it's something that can ring true to developing your game, is she has phenomenal, like, never say die attitude in the cage. Phenomenal heart. She's like a great fighter who, when they face adversity in the cage, when they're losing, she doesn't pack it in. It almost, like, inspires her to try harder. And we kind of saw this in a small scale in the Osovich fight. Just straight up lost the first round and, you know, dusted her shoulders off, came out, and got the submission in the second round. So that's something I think we've seen before, is she really does have a hell of a, like, a fighting spirit about her.
The final thing I want to mention about UFC Brooklyn is Cerrone Hernandez, which signed me up for Cerrone McGregor. I think we have talked about that. That is a fight to make. But, you know, one of the things of, you know, and this happens in MMA all the time, where a fighter, the week of the fight, really starts selling the fight, and people are like, oh, man, how great that was. And then he loses, and then they just want to just crap all over that fighter. And that's what we saw with Alexander Hernandez. Look, he took advantage of that microphone time on Thursday, and Cerrone just, you know, just showed, you know, and just, you know, outclassed him.
Yeah, that's to me, Don Cerrone was the number two talking point, or number two fighter out of the UFC card. Dude earned himself a lot of money there if Conor actually fights him. It was a great fight. Alexander is going to come back, and Alexander the Great will be great, I'm sure. But this was Donald Cerrone's night, the better striker, and he caught the head kick in the second round, and he did justice on ESPN, just a phenomenal guy to throw on ESPN. Donald Cerrone was the big winner. Alexander Hernandez may be the breakout fighter next year, Jason, but this year it might be Donald Cerrone. Other things on the card that jumped out to me was, like, on the prelims, you know, shout out to Dennis Bermudez, who retired. I feel like the ESPN Plus broadcast could have gone a little longer since we are delaying for basketball. They kind of cut his feet short. Alonzo Menifield is going to be a beast at light heavyweight. He just destroyed his opponent. And then two other things. Kyle Robeson's really going to be like just kicking himself. He nearly put away Glover Teixeira with those elbows. I thought we were starting off the ESPN Plus broadcast with an upset, but Glover responded. And lastly, Gregor Gillespie is, like, awesome against Jesse Medeiros. Kind of boring in the first round for the fans, but, you know, he's out there explaining himself in the post-fight interview. And he's just one hell of a wrestler. Getting the finish over Medeiros, kind of progressing his career. Obviously a fighter at lightweight that I think down the line is going to – I mean, him versus Khabib, I think, is what's on everyone's mind down the line.
Also got to mention Jeff Neal's win, and how goddamn tough is Bilal Muhammad. I mean, there was multiple times that fight, I'm like, oh, this fight's over, and he just kept surviving, but big win there by Jeff Neal. So that definitely stuck out to me. But overall, great night of fights. Of course, we're no UFC card this week. Of course, they've got the card on ESPN Plus on Super Bowl weekend, so look forward to seeing that one. Rafael Assuncao, Marlon Moraes, big matchup there. At 135 pounds. But coming up next, we're going to get you ready for Bellator 214. Before we get into the fight card, going to let you hear my conversations with Aaron Pico, Juan Archuleta, and Ricky Banteos. Of course, Aaron Pico will be in the co-main event of Bellator 214, as he's going to be taking on Henry Corrales. And then Archuleta and Banteos are taking on each other at Bellator 214. So you're going to hear those interviews now. And then when we get back, we're going to talk about Bellator 214. Joining me now here on the MMA Report, man, it's going to be in the co-main event of Bellator 214. He takes on Henry Corrales. It is Aaron Pico. Aaron, how you doing?
All is well, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing very good, very good. I was watching an interview you did last year with Jay Glazer, and one of the things that came up where it was talking about what makes you different. I mean, we've seen, obviously everyone knew about you before coming in MMA, but what do you think makes you different than every other MMA fighter that's out there that has not gotten to where you've gotten so quickly?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I still don't think I can answer it at 100%. I mean, I just think what's made me different is I've just stayed the course ever since I was a kid. I've had some, obviously some tough times and certain things and certain situations, but for the most part, I just kept going. It sounds, people probably say you got to just keep going, but I really have just kept going. I lived it every single day. When I was a kid, I was wrestling all the time. When I started boxing, I was in the boxing club every day, and I ultimately did what my passion was, and I was just fighting in combat sports and nothing really. People always say you're different, but I don't know. I just wake up and I do what I do, and time gets hard. I can turn to my family. I'm very fortunate that I have a family that supports me, and I wish I can give you a solid answer, but I just keep going no matter what. Just keep going forward. That's what I live by.
One of the things I've also seen, when other people talk about you, they talk about how mentally strong you are. I was watching an interview where TJ Dillashaw was talking about just how mentally strong you are. Where does that, is that just come from just early on when you were getting involved in boxing and wrestling and everything else, that you mentally just had it where other people didn't?
I just have never been afraid to fail. I've always, my parents have always encouraged me to just take risks. Like, hey, you want to go wrestle for a world championship? Go wrestle for a world championship, you know? And at the end of the day, I know that I have my family to lean on. If it goes great, hey, we all celebrate together. If it doesn't go great, then hey, we still are a family. We stick together and we figure out what we need to do. So I've never not felt that I was going to be, like, I always thought everything was going to be okay. So it allowed me to take those risks, having the support of my family. So, yeah, I think, of course, times get hard and you have to make a decision in your mind. Do I keep going or do I back off? And for me, I always said, you know what, I'm going to keep going. I had a bad sparring day when I was a kid. I got get my ass kicked. I'm going to show up the next day and I'm going to figure out what I did wrong and learn from it. And I've always kept that mentality, and it's gotten me a long way. So,
what do you think is the biggest risk that you've taken in MMA so far?
I mean, my first one going up to 154 or going to 155 Madison Square Garden was obviously a big risk, but it was a good thing what happened to me, honestly. I mean, I think every fight that any fighter goes into is a risk. Anything that you do at our level is a risk. So every fight is a risk. Some obviously are bigger than others, but anytime you step in that cage, there's a risk of getting hurt. There's a risk of getting knocked out, choked out. So there's a risk in everything. There's a risk driving your car down the street.
You tweeted earlier today where you said, you mentioned about how this is, the last week of preparations, everything is done. The goal is to stay sharp and focus on the game plan. Has focusing on the game plan, whether we're talking about MMA, boxing, wrestling, has that ever been an issue for you? Just, keeping that focus during a week of competition?
Yeah. I mean, as you get older, you get wiser, and obviously I'm still young, but I've, gone through a lot of stuff in my life, in my athletic career. When you get closer to the fight, sometimes people think, oh, I got to keep going. I don't want to take a break. So for me, as I've gotten, more fights under me, more experience over the years, just relax. The work has been done. There's more damage that you can do in the last 2 weeks than good. So take it one day at a time, make sure your weight is good, and which my weight is where it needs to be. So just relax, go see a movie, walk around, I haven't been able to ride my horse because it's been so rainy, but yeah, usually at the horse stables, relaxing. Bottom line is all the work has been done, and just relax and wait for January 26th.
I had a chance to talk to your opponent, Henry Corrales, and one of the things that he talked about is he said, he goes, look, Aaron's all the hype around him is justified. He's a great fighter. For you, what's your thoughts of Henry? I mean, this is a guy that, you know, had some things not go his way early on in Bellator, goes to the MMA lab, and he's been on a roll. What's your thoughts of him, of what you've been able to see on tape?
Yeah, the respect is mutual. I think he's a very tough guy. He gets his opponents very, very tired, and they're not able to endure certain things, and he just overwhelms his opponents, and he's a tough guy. But for me personally, I feel my speed is faster than him, my cardio is better, my wrestling is better, and I feel the fight is I'm in a good position to win the fight, and we will win the fight. It's just not getting overly excited, just letting the fight happen rather than just rushing things. If I just relax and use my skills, I think the fight is going to be a great night for us, and make no mistake about it, he is a tough guy, and he's fought some veterans in Bellator that have won world titles, Patricio and all them. So yeah, you know, I'm bringing my A game, and best believe when you fight Aaron Pico, you better bring your A game and some, because I'm bringing everything that I have.
Hearing what you're saying there, talking about, you know, not rushing things, whatnot. I mean, do you view the fight game as like, look, as long as I don't beat myself, there's no one who can beat me.
You're right about that. I mean, I have all the skill sets in the world. Obviously, I'm getting better and better as a fighter, and that just comes with age. Sometimes you can't rush things. I have all the skill sets, but I just, you know, need time to develop, get more awareness and things like that. And like I said, 3-4 years from now, I will be the best pound-for-pound fighter on this planet. Make no mistake about it. Am I there yet? I'm going to be real with you. I'm not there yet. But that's okay. That's what you wake up, and that's what you train for every single day. But make no mistake about it. 3-4 years from now, I will be the best pound-for-pound fighter on this planet.
So if we're talking a scale of 1 to 10, where are you at right now in terms of showing that you're the best fighter on the planet?
Just think about it. I've only been a professional 2 years. So I still have a lot more things to learn, and more. I don't even know how much. I haven't even been in the cage a whole round. So it's kind of hard to base anything off of that until I have a 3-round fight or 2-round, and I can see more of myself. For me, it's been so quick, you know, quick knockouts, and I can't give you an exact answer because I don't have enough film on myself or that. But personally, I feel I'm well on my way from where I started 2 years ago to where I am now. I'm starting to feel what works for me and what doesn't. And there's only one thing in this fight game that you can't rush, and it's time. You just need time to develop. You need time to see different partners, and ultimately you need time in the cage. You have to see the live fire. You can be so good on the target, but until those bullets start flying past your head, we'll see how you react. And, you know, so far so good. I had a hiccup in my first fight, but that's okay. I mean, I came on to win 4 knockouts in a row. So I feel we're well on our way. I'm ahead of a lot of people that were 22, and we just focus on getting better.
It almost kind of feels like, and if you get a win here and you go out and do what you've done in your last 4 fights, that you've got to be in the conversation for a title fight. But I get the sense that you're kind of like, I'm not rushing to get there.
I'm in no rush to win the title, but if they presented me the opportunity to fight for a title, I absolutely would take it. I am in no rush. I have a lot of the step up in competition that I've been taking is just. It's undeniable that I'm going to get to the title, and the guys that I keep fighting, yeah, I'm well on my way to being champion, and I want to be the champion. I want to be a young champion. But we'll see. If they gave me the opportunity, I would take it. But all I can do is focus on getting better, winning my fights like I have been, but to be clear, if they offered me a title fight, I would definitely do it. But I'm in no rush. I'm young. I know I have time to develop. Listen, here's the thing. If you're the champion, if I was in Patricio's pit bull's position, I would be trying to fight myself right now. And the reason is because the longer the time goes on, the more fights I get, the more experience, the more dangerous I'm going to get. So with that being said, if I was him, I would be trying to fight me right now. And for me, I'm one of those young fighters that want to show that I'm the best. And sometimes it can get you in trouble, but I have great coaches around me to help me prepare for big fights. And I have that energy. I have that hunger. I want certain things out of life. And there's only one way, by doing that, and that's fighting tough guys. I know a lot of people say, oh, you take risks, but hey, you have to take risk in order to, you know, get rewards. And I'm willing to do that. I put in the time and the work every single day with my team. And, we're going to be the champions. And if it's now, great. If it's in 2023, great. I'm in no rush, but I definitely would fight for a title whenever they gave me the opportunity.
And of course, up first is your matchup with Henry Krause, a co-main event of Bellator 214, which comes up on Saturday night, January 26th, live on the Paramount Network, starting at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, also streaming on DAZN. Aaron, as always, I appreciate your time and look forward to the fight here.
My pleasure.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a Maskway, a part of Bellator 214, coming up on Saturday night, January 26th in Inglewood, California. It's Juan Archuleta. Juan, how you doing, man?
Yes, sir. What's up, Jason? How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. I cannot complain. I don't think it was a huge shock of you going down to 135 pounds since you had fought there before. But what ultimately decided why this was the time to go down to 35 or return to 35?
Definitely opportunity, man. I mean, we out here in California, we're making a huge statement for the 135 division. You know, you got Aaron Pico, AJ McKee, and just all these stud fighters that are making the featherweight just a strong division. And you know, looking at it, I was like, man, I've made my stake. You know, I've made my claim of who I am as the 45er. You know, why not be diverse and drop down and show them how diverse I could really be? You know,
I mean, simply put, is it just, look, this is the quickest road to a title shot?
No, because, you know, I'm not worried about a title shot. I know that Horiguchi has the next title fight, you know, per contract of what they had negotiated for the Rizin fight with Darien going out there and fighting. So I knew that I'm going to have to take a backseat anyway. But, you know, just making noise, just being diverse and being a true MMA fighter of, you know, making martial arts the main gist of, you know, my diversity in fighting.
You had a recent tweet a couple of days ago where you talked about, you know, 2 weeks from today, I'll weigh in at 136 and be prepared for the biggest test of my career. Why do you feel like this is the biggest test of your career?
You know, for one, my opponent, you know, Ricky Bandejas, you know, looking into his career, he's had a stellar career like I have, you know, and he's up and comer and he's only going to get better. You know, he's starting to catch his rhythm. I knew what it was like when I was 11-1 and I started finally finding myself as an MMA fighter and, you know, putting all my chips into the basket and saying, all right, let's really do this. And I think with the a good knockout that he had, overcoming all the adversity that he did and the, you know, the mental bullying that Gallagher did to him, and still being able to stay calm, cool, collective, and going in there and putting on a performance that he did, you know, it showed a true martial artist. And that's what I'm about, fighting true martial artists and testing myself against that caliber. You know, I'm people are considering me an up and comer, you know, or a guy that's just starting out, you know, to make waves. You know, I wasn't a big, you know, blue chip recruit, so to speak, going into Bellator. So making my name now, and, you know, Ricky Bandejas making the name off Gallagher, you know, I feel like it's two guys that people would love to see fight, you know, for a potential title fight after.
Obviously, Ricky is a guy that I was well aware of before he came into Bellator. Do you remember when you saw that fight against James? Were you surprised the fact of people were, I don't know if doubting him is the right word, but kind of, you know, was looking at him as a massive underdog in that fight?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, shoot, man, the guy had a 10-1 record, you know, with finishes, and it was just like, man, like, something about this kid is gonna piss people off after this fight, you know. And for him to go out there and do it in like 3 minutes was unbelievable. It's hilarious, you know. And it was just like, and it just showed, you know, it just shows that, you know, that there's talent out there, and when they get an opportunity to shine on a big platform, they're gonna take full advantage of it.
One of the things when you go to tell the tape of this fight, the one thing that does stick out to you is a height advantage that you do have in this fight. How big of an advantage is that truly? Or is that something that from the outside looking in, we look at that as a huge advantage, but maybe it's not as big of an advantage as people may think?
You know what? I think we're the same size. You know, I think a little different. You know, I walk around telling people I'm truly 5'7" and a half, you know, but people are like, no, you're at least 5'8". And I'm like, I don't know, man. When I measure myself when I'm barefooted, I step on the tape measure and it says 5'7" and a half. And they're like, oh, you need a new tape measure because you're 5'8". I'm like, all right. But, you know, it says that he's 5'10". And I'm just like, there's no way. But, you know, so I don't know how long he really is. I know his length. I have a 69-inch reach. He has a 71. So I know his length is a little bit bigger. But, you know, as far as height-wise, I'm pretty sure we have the same height. But, you know, height and reach doesn't mean anything to me, honestly. I go in there and I use my footwork and I close the distance as quick as I can and as explosive as I can so I could get the fight to where I need it to be.
Obviously, anyone who follows you on social media, we know who you train with. What do you, when you're around a guy like TJ Dillashaw, a champion who's obviously got a huge fight, what have you taken away from him on just how he mentally and physically prepares himself, you know, for a fight?
Yeah, I'm an observer. You know, I sit back and I analyze a lot as well. You know, when I started the career out, I was around fighters, like big name fighters, Cub Swanson, Joe Benavidez, you know, TJ Dillashaw, Tim Elliott when he fought Demetrius. And I just sat back and I observed them. You know, I observed the media. I observed and analyzed everything that was going on with their weight cut, their preparation, who they had around them. And I just took it all in. And, you know, and then after I got to a certain point, I wanted a certain team around me. And the training lab started, and we started picking these guys and putting these people in these places that I had been around. And the coaching, you know, that took off with it has just been, you know, a blessing from God. And it's just been impactful for all of our careers and showing. And, you know, so the biggest thing I took off of watching him is professionalism. You know, weight's not a factor. Showing up to the fight's not a factor. I'm going to go in, I'm going to put on the best performance I can, have fun, but throughout the process, I'm going to train my ass off and make sure that I'm ready for that night because that's what the fans deserve.
Of course, it's a big night for Bellator. It's a great night of fights. I mean, as you were coming up the local scene there in California, did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams you'd be fighting on the same card as Fedor Emelianenko?
Definitely not a Fedor Emelianenko, but definitely I envisioned myself fighting at the Forum. But I've been a huge Fedor fan my whole life. You know, who hasn't that the people that follow MMA hasn't been a Fedor fan? You know, he's one of the reasons why we're at where we're at, you know, in MMA, you know, and it is a true blessing. And once I found out it was going to be at the Forum and I had, I think, 8 weeks in between my fight to this fight, I beg and pleaded to be on this card and they got it done. My management did. And Scott Coker and Rich Chow and Mike Hogan. So thank them so much for having this opportunity.
Was fighting at the Forum like a bucket list item for you?
Yeah, going through there and seeing your friends fight and walking through the back and, you know, just watching a lot of performances there. I always just seen myself putting on a great show at the Forum, you know, closing my eyes, watching myself walk down the, you know, steps into the cage had always been an insight on me, the parking, everything. You know, I've envisioned all this and it's not going to be anything new for me. I'm going to take it all in as much as I can and go out there and put on a performance.
Is there any other bucket list venues that you want to fight at before, you know, you call it a career?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of them that I haven't fought at, you know, Madison Square Garden, you got Staples Center, you got out in Risen, you know, anywhere out in Japan, you really want to fight. And, you know, out in Barcelona or Spain, anywhere in Spain, you know, and I know that we just signed a huge deal with the Europe League. And I definitely want to, that's why, you know, to me, fighting for a title isn't the most important thing on my list right now because I want to go out and do a Europe tour and for Bellator and fight as much as they can out there. And if it happens to be for a title and I carry the title through Europe, that'll be ideal.
Final thing, Juan, I really appreciate the time. No matter what happens here at Bellator 214, obviously you're planning on going out there and winning. Is your next fight at 35 or 45?
So with this is my last fight on my contract. So, you know, it's definitely going to make me the biggest free agent in MMA for 2018. But, you know, it's something that's going to go in negotiation, talk with my manager and Scott Coker and these guys, which I'm excited for, you know, and you know, the option's always out there for me to fight 135, 145, and 155, just to make it more diversity in what they need, where they need star lineups at, and I'm just showing that I'm capable of doing all three weight classes.
I mean, do you almost feel like you're kind of betting on yourself here a little bit with you know, fighting out your deal to get to potentially free agency?
It was honestly nothing that was intended, just because how quick my last fight was. Usually, you know, a couple people get a couple months in between fights. It was just, you know, pleading to get on to fight in front of my hometown and my home crowd was what the setback was. But it's definitely, I'm definitely re-signing, you know, with my management going into renegotiation with them. But, you know, it's just something that they gave me the opportunity to do, to fight at the Forum, and so it was an opportunity I couldn't pass up before renegotiating.
Juan, I really appreciate time. Of course, everyone's going to be able to see your fight here Saturday night, January 26th, live on the Paramount Network. Also, will be streamed on DAZN as well. Juan, appreciate the time, and good luck here at Bellator 214.
Yeah, Jason, I just want to give you a huge shout out and a huge thank you for everything that you do for the sport as well. And, you know, your followers, you know, you guys have a great following. And I just want to thank them for listening in and tuning in. And thank you for a job well done.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man's going to be part of Bellator 214, coming Saturday night, January 26th, from the Forum in Inglewood, California. It's Ricky Bandejas, who's going to take on Juan Archuleta. Ricky, how's things been, man?
Hey, man, everything's going good. How are you?
I'm doing very good, doing very good. I know as a fighter, you don't always get to control the narrative of what is said about you. If you could kind of control the narrative of what people would think when they hear your name, what would that be?
You know, sidekick to James Gallagher's face.
You know, obviously, you made a you know, a huge... I think everyone on social media that night went crazy. Were you a big Shawn Michaels fan growing up?
No, I definitely knew who he was. I was into the wrestling scene. So when I saw the memes going around, I definitely knew how it related, but wasn't a huge fan.
I know.
I wish I was, though, now.
it was a couple weeks ago, I saw your manager, Brian Hamper, had put this tweet out about something James Gallagher has said, how you turned down the rematch and all this. And I think for a lot of people, they're sitting there going, there's no need for a rematch. You went there and you clearly beat him. Has there been anything that has been said over the past couple months that has pissed you off? Or are you just like, dude, I beat you, move on?
Yeah, I can't imagine him wanting a rematch. You know, he lost once. He still has people pretend that it might have been a fluke. But like, fight again, he loses. No one's going to want to hear from him anymore. Like, he could still redeem his career.
And you've got, obviously, you now have this huge match that you've been preparing for. Juan Archuleta, who's returned to 35. I mean, he's got a great record, just like you have a great record. And when I spoke to him, he said, he goes, look, I'm not a trash talker. Ricky's not a trash talker. We're just two elite martial artists that are going to go in there. Kind of, as you have gotten ready for this fight, what has stuck out to you about Ricky of why, or Juan, and why he's been able to put together such an impressive record?
He's just tough, man. You can tell he puts his time in the gym. He's good everywhere. He's got great cardio. He breaks a lot of guys. He puts, you know, pressure on and everybody falls. So he's just a well-rounded fighter.
Do you kind of feel like that people haven't put that pressure onto him like he puts pressure onto his opponent?
Yes. Every fight I see him, the one coming forward. I never really saw anybody put pressure on him. So on the next Saturday, you're going to see, you know, how he reacts to that.
In terms of, you know, they always talk about the key to victory of what you need to go out there. And, you know, every fighter says, look, this is about me. It's not about my opponent. But what do you see as your keys to victory besides putting the pressure on him?
You know, just stay low, watch out for the overhands, and put pressure. You know, pretty simple fight. You know, we match up really well. So it's going to come down to whoever makes more mistakes that night.
You, obviously, a potential win here could obviously put you in line for a title shot. We'll see what happens with Caldwell and Horiguchi when that rematch takes place. But, I mean, is your mindset of like, look, I know I'm fighting for a title shot at some point with the win here?
Yeah, I cannot imagine the winner not getting a title shot. 21-1, 11-1. Caldwell's beat almost everybody in the 35-pound division, so I can't imagine the winner not being next in line.
And Caldwell, I know I was watching an interview, you talked about it, and you mentioned about how you felt Juan was a more difficult, challenging type fight because of you felt that really Darion is one dimensional. I mean, what about Juan makes him what you believe is a tougher fight?
He's got wins everywhere. He's got some knockouts. He's got some submissions, some decisions. And when he goes out there, he's willing to throw his hands. When you watch Caldwell fight, he's looking to shoot over and over again. And he tends to get tired. You know, all his fights, he seems to get a little gas. As for Archuleta, he wins by getting the other guy tired.
And I know how much your family is a part of your life. I was watching a video when you were fighting for Cage Free that talked about you and your wife and your kids. What's your wife think about you being a fighter?
She hates it. You know, she gets all nervous and stuff, but she supports it. Like, it's a hate-love relationship for her. She doesn't like the nervous part, but she loves when we fight and we win. So, it's a coin toss.
Do you get nervous before a fight?
Absolutely. Very nervous. You know, not nervous because of the guy or not nervous because I'm going to get hurt. I'm just, you're nervous. You don't want to lose. You know, everybody's watching. You put a lot of effort in, a lot of time. There's money on the line. There's a lot that goes into it, so you don't want to lose.
In terms of all the time and effort that goes into preparing for a fight, I mean, for my listener out there that is thinking about what is a schedule like day-to-day for you, I mean, are we talking like you're up at like 5 o'clock in the morning and you're not going to bed till 11 o'clock at night?
No, not like that. When I used to work, I've been fighting full-time since August 2017, but prior to that, it was getting up at 5 o'clock, training, going home, going to bed. But luckily, you know, I've been able to just fight. So I wake up whenever, and then I train. You know, I put in a couple hours at the gym every day. Nothing too crazy.
One of the things that I do find interesting about is your father being in your corner. What does your father say to you on fight night? Is it just he just kind of knows what to say to you to get the best out of you?
Yeah, you know, it's just nice to. It is a journey. It's a big piece of my life, you know, and why not bring him along? You know, I didn't have a third person, but why not share it with him? And he doesn't say much. He knows that the fight day, nobody really speaks, kind of quiet, and it's just nice to share a moment like that, you know, getting the W and moving on.
If you were not a fighter, what do you think you'd be doing right now?
Me? Well, I was a carpenter building high-rises in up in the city, New York and Jersey City. So I'd probably be doing that still. I have my bachelor's in accounting. So, but I didn't work in that. I just got my degree in that.
Is there ever a thought of some point you could be an accountant, or is it kind of like, I think it's kind of past?
No, I could definitely, you know, jump ship if I have to. You know, I could see myself doing it. I don't mind it. I'm pretty good with numbers. So it's not something I would, I'd rather pick the fighting road. But if that doesn't work out, there's always plan B.
Now, are you like the in-house accountant for fighters in the gym that they go to you to get their taxes done?
No. Most people don't even know I have my bachelor's degree, let alone in accounting.
What is it? Do you think it's because people are just surprised that would be your degree?
No, I just think, you know, I fight, you know, and I've been good at fighting, so no one's ever really asked me, you know. This is the first time somebody asked what I would be doing if I wasn't a fighter.
They always talk about there's like these perceptions that the common person has about fighters, and I know I've talked to a lot of guys that will talk about is the things that people think about fighters that totally aren't true. Like Benson Henderson one time, you know, said to me, he goes, people are surprised to learn that I'm college educated. For you, is there a perception out there that maybe people have of you because you're a fighter that just totally is not true?
Yeah, it tends to be that a lot of people think fighters that just come from broken past, or they come from, you know, falling off the path where they didn't go to school or they didn't get a 40-hour job a week. You know, nobody thinks, like, there's a lot of fighters that are educated. You know, just because you're a fighter doesn't make you dumb or broken or have a bad past, you know, a bad rap sheet. Nowadays, anybody could be a fighter.
Are there people that you grew up with that are just can't believe that you're a professional fighter?
No. I thought a lot of people would feel that way, but it tends to be everybody around me, they kind of just, they could have saw this in my future, which I never saw. I thought they'd be surprised.
And, of course, we're going to be able to see your fight come up on Saturday night, January 26th, live on the Paramount Network, also streaming live on DAZN. It is Bellator 214. You'll see Ricky's fight against Juan Archuleta, part of that main card. Ricky, man, I appreciate time. Look forward to seeing the fight here at Bellator 214.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Daniel, there was my conversations with Aaron Pico, Juan Archuleta, and Ricky Bandejas. Kind of interesting hearing Aaron Pico talk about when I asked him about, hey, you know, what about a title shot? He's like, look, if they offered to me, I'm not turning it down. But really the big takeaway from that conversation was Aaron saying, look, I'm not trying to rush my development. But he does know that sometimes you do have to take risks to get those rewards. Juan Archuleta talking about his return to bantamweight. Of course, he fought as a bantamweight on the regional scene, also as a featherweight. Also talked about free agency. Last fight on his Bellator contract. So if he goes out and wins on Saturday night against Ricky and Bandejas, and let's just say it's in a spectacular fashion, he puts himself in a good situation. And then, of course, Ricky Bandejas talking about the James Gallagher sweet chin music he threw. Fact that he has an accounting degree, and one of the things he talked about the fight was he hasn't seen people put those pressure on Juan in his previous fight, so that's going to be very interesting. I tell you what, when you look at those, those three fights, the main event, Pico Corrales, Archuleta Bandejas, I mean, we always talk about Daniel of, give us a reason to sit at home on a Friday or Saturday night. And by damn, Bellator has done that with Bellator 214. You have given me multiple reasons to make sure I'm in front of my television set. I've got my DAZN popped up because, well, I don't have Paramount Network, so I got to watch the fights on DAZN to sit there and watch Bellator 214.
Dude, these fights are awesome. These top three fights. I mean, Aaron Pico, must-see TV. Henry Corral is one hell of a challenger, one hell of a step up. Risk-taking has been Pico's MO since day one. Something that probably led to his debut loss, but it's something that will lead to plenty of success going forward. I mean, Archuleta Bandejas, talk about a fight where when you think about who you're going to pick, you go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I mean, that's one hell of a fight. Archuleta, I think, has way more fights on his resume. You feel safer about picking him. But Bandejas, man, he flashes. Between his personality and his in-ring work, he flashes a lot of potential. So I've gone back and forth, and then the main event, Fedor and Bader. Oh my gosh. I mean, Ryan Bader should, by all accounts, go in that cage, knock out Fedor, get his check, get his title belt. But there's a little something in the air, Jason. You know, one last run by the last emperor, Fedor Emelianenko. I didn't really expect him to get this far. I knew Bellator was going to put him in a position to do so with the way they bracketed things out. So what do we have here? A can't-miss prospect in Aaron Pico against a veteran in Corrales. Two of the top prospects in Bellator between Archuleta and Bandejas, and a fight to crown the heavyweight champion that's going to tell a phenomenal story.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing you have to give the entire Bellator team credit for this is it's not like you have this very marketable fighter in Fedor and we're just putting a bunch of showcase fights on of our young upcoming talent. They've put on, two fights that we're talking about, Pico Corrales, Archuleta Bandejas, that are just great fights of up-and-coming guys that, you look in both fights, it's not that hard to say that these guys are going to be potentially fighting for a Bellator title at some point in 2019. And of course, we also have got the MMA debut of Jake Hager, a.k.a. Jack Swagger, taking on J.W. Kaiser, which this is the thing I wrote down about that fight is, what should we expect from Jake Hager? And I don't know the answer. Is it Brock Lesnar? And I think there's obviously the correlation there because of the amateur wrestling being, Division I wrestler there at Oklahoma State, where, of course, Brock was at Minnesota, which, by the way, I saw Brock was actually training with the Minnesota wrestling team. Or is it CM Punk? Or is it somewhere in the middle? And I don't know what to expect. I do believe that this is a situation that Hager's management and Bellator this is not earth-shattering news here, Daniel. Look, they believe he's going to beat J.W. Kaiser. They were not putting him in against an opponent they think he cannot beat. But I don't know what to expect, and there is going to be a different set of eyeballs on Bellator on Saturday night because of Jake Hager.
And the other thing is, I was listening to the Wrestling Observer Radio, and there's this group of wrestlers starting this new wrestling company called All Elite Wrestling.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You mentioned it last week. Dave Meltzer said it was just a passing comment, but that they were thinking of going to this event as like a, you know, like a rally. Cause that's kind of the way, like their first show's in May. So they really do these things where they go to different, you know, pro wrestling events and, you know, create social media buzz. So he did mention they were going to go there, and, you know, Jack Swagger maybe, or Jake Hager maybe a part of that promotion. So keep an eye out for that. They're California guys, and, you know, it's in Inglewood, California. So you may see that there, and you know, we could talk about it next week if that actually happens. So keep an eye out for that. I don't know. I know Jake Hager's wrestling, and it's hard, I think, to be a pro wrestler and MMA fighter at the same time. Bobby Lashley did it, and that's kind of what I would expect, a worse version of Bobby Lashley. Because mm-hmm. I just think Bobby so when you look at pro wrestlers transitioning to mixed martial arts, you got to look at, I think, like credentials or resume and experience and also athleticism. Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley, I think, are better athletes than Jake Hager. But Jake Hager is a much better athlete and a much better resume than CM Punk. So I think we're going to see Jake Hager go out there and absolutely destroy bums, or at least beat them, you know, with dominant positioning and eventually ground and pound. But once he fights better guys, he's going to struggle. He's just a bit too old. I think he's like 37. And he doesn't come across like a freak athlete like Brock Lesnar. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. This is all hearsay. At the end of the day, this guy wins. You put him on the microphone, he'll be all right. He wasn't the best promo in the WWE. He wasn't a huge star. He was a former WWE champion, but they gave him the belt, and he wasn't super marketable with it. He wasn't a major star. So it's not like he's the greatest promo in the world, but maybe without the WWE writers and that atmosphere, just free as be. He'll cut a good promo afterwards, but yeah, dude, he's gonna beat JW Kaiser. If he doesn't, that's just an embarrassment. Because, you know, I mean, they're setting up for success here.
Yeah, yeah. There's no question. I mean, look, I think that this is set up for Jake to win, but yeah, I don't know what to expect, and that is part of the intrigue of what you know, he might look like in terms of the main event: Fedor Emelianenko versus Ryan Bader. I know we all sit here and believe Ryan Bader is going to win. But why do I feel like Bader is going to not necessarily have a striking matchup? He's going to use his wrestling, and Fedor is going to catch him in a submission.
I mean, it would be a special moment, and that's a gut instinct. I'm going to pick Bader for sure. He's just a better fighter, in my opinion. No matter how hard I scratch my eyes, I still can't get that Fedor versus Fabio Maldonado fight out of my eyes.
Yeah.
And Bader is just a premier light heavyweight. But hey, man, we've seen Bader falter. What was it like? Let's see. Well, it was 7 years ago. But when he lost to Tito Ortiz, that was crazy. I had no expectation that he was going to lose to Ortiz coming off the John Jones fight. So, you know, early, you know, we could definitely get caught in a submission, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think wrestling with Fedor is a bad idea just because he is such a good submission grappler, and this is a 5-round fight. Striking with him, he does have sneaky power. I do understand. I can kind of sense the feeling too that like something crazy is going to happen. Fedor is going to end the night as a champion, but I think there's just a huge mismatch right now in terms of talent and in terms of physical skill set.
Yeah,
I think Bader's going to win.
I think I'm interested on Friday at the weigh-ins just to kind of see how much of a weight difference there is between Fedor and Bader. I mean, I would expect Bader's probably going to be in that 225, maybe as much as 230 range, where, you know, Fedor could be probably in that 240-ish range. You know, so that's one thing that interests me. But yeah, I agree with you. You know, the smart money would say Ryan Bader's going to win this one. But I feel like if he tries to kind of fight the way he did against Matt Mitrione and take the fight to the ground, that he's got to be extra careful because, you know, there's some tricks that Fedor is going to have. But, you know, there's definitely that aspect. It's that nostalgia that, you know, it's Fedor Emelianenko fighting. And yes, I mean, I'm with you totally. You can't get that Fabio Maldonado fight out of your head. You know, you can't. But I'm interested to watch the fight, though.
Me too, man. I really am. And I am excited for this Bellator card. I mean, I just think Bellator's going to have a lot of solid cards this year. It seems like they're starting to get their ducks in a row. And, you know, it's going to be a while until we get a card with the top three fights as good as this one, but, you know, we got plenty of stat quality here. I mean, look, simply put, if Aaron Pico wins this fight, it's probably the last time we ever see him not in the main event.
Here's, you know, I had the, you know, asked him about the whole title fight. It would not shock me if Aaron Pico wins, they offer him Patricio Pitbull.
I don't think so either.
You know, I was thinking about this. Think about the matchmaking Aaron Pico has had in his, now this going into his sixth pro fight, in comparison to his teammate AJ McKee.
Yeah, it's a bit different, isn't it?
We're not in the same universe.
Yeah, one row's a little more difficult.
I mean, like, you know, this is, and this is a tough one for me to pick. It really is. Like, here is, I don't think it's a big question, but I think in terms of MMA, it is a question. What happens if this fight hits the second round? We haven't seen Aaron Pico in MMA fight in the second round. I don't think cardio is going to be an issue. But could there be an adrenaline dump? And all of a sudden, Henry, is it wrong of me to think that the longer this fight goes, the more it favors Henry Corrales?
I think the longer it goes, the better it does, for sure. Just because he's battle-tested and proven, whereas Pico isn't. There's always questions as we watch these guys start off as high-level prospects, because we don't have the track record that we have with someone like Henry Gonzalez, where we've seen them put in different situations, and one of those situations is a long-time fight. So I think it definitely favors it, but no matter what, I still think Pico, round 1-3, is going to be the better fighter. I just think he's a phenomenal talent. I don't think this goes past the second round, and I think he gets an impressive finish and calls out the champion.
This is just me being just flat out honest. God, I've got a good relationship with Henry Corrales. It's tough for me to pick against him. That is just being just straight up honest. I've been talking to this guy for probably 3 years now, and when you, as a interviewer, you develop, you know, this relationship where you know, and it's just tough. I mean, it's just. But, yeah, it is kind of tough going against Aaron Pico. It just is.
Pick Corrales, man. You're the one who gets the interviews. I'm the one who doesn't talk to anyone.
But I'll tell you, man, I love talking. Aaron Pico, when I talk to him, and the interview earlier on the show is another example of this, I feel like you just learn a little bit more, and he gives you something in every interview. He's one of my favorite interviews to talk to, just because he's just, you know, I feel like I get something, but I love that fight. Archuleta Bendejas, I love that fight. That's such a great fight. And, you know, Ricky talked about it. Said, you know, no one's pressured Juan Archuleta, and he's going to pressure him. I mean, this is a high-level fight. I mean, yes, I in terms of, if you don't necessarily always watch the Bellator product, these are probably names that you have no idea who they are. But this is just high-level MMA. I think this is going to go all 15 minutes. It wouldn't surprise me if it's a split decision either way. Just a great fight.
Just a great fight. I feel bad about it because, like, I think Archuleta's going to win. I mean, he really impressed me in that fight against Robbie Peralta. But the thing is, picking Archuleta, you feel bad because you don't pick Bendejas. You know, I wish there was a way I could pick both guys. Maybe a draw. Both these guys are awesome talents, and if you don't know who they are, you're going to watch the card, and I think you're going to be left with a great fight. I think Bendejas is going to push the pace. That may be a bad idea, though. But again, I'm just looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a high-action fight. And regardless of the result, I think both guys are going to have pretty promising careers going forward.
And this may not be the first time they fight. We may get at least one more. I mean, and it's going to be. I mean, what if Archuleta goes out there and has a spectacular victory? I mean, he puts himself in a great situation heading into free agency. And is that something that the UFC would look at and say, you know, we want this guy? I mean, he's gambling on himself here. I'm sure Bellator probably tried to get him to a new deal before this fight. But if he goes out there and wins, puts himself in a good situation because, you know, I mean, look, you look at the Bellator 135-pound division, there's not a lot of depth there. And that's an issue right now that Bellator has. So I love this fight. In terms of the prelims, Daniel, there's not a lot that sticks out to you. I mean, look, this is just this is what Bellator prelim cards are pretty much. They are local fight cards, but there is three fighters on the main card, on the prelims that you got to stick out to. One of them, Desmond Torres, who actually have a conversation up with him on the MMAReport.com. He's taking on Steve Ramirez in a bantamweight matchup. Another one is Chris Gonzalez, as he's taking on Henry Mendez. This will be a lightweight matchup. You know, Chris Gonzalez was on the Greco-Roman World Team in 2016, was a six-time Greco All-American. He made his amateur debut in December of 2017. He got a 50-second submission victory at an event in California. Then he ended up getting a TKO victory before signing with Bellator in December. He trains at Team Alpha Male. He is someone to definitely pay attention to. The other one, and I'm going to let Daniel, because apparently Daniel knows how to say his last name a little better than I am. AJ, Daniel, how do you say his last name?
Agazarm, of course.
Okay, cool. I'm going to go with that. Making his pro debut. He was a D1 wrestler at Ohio State. He's been competing in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's a black belt, a four-time IBJJF European Open champion, a Brazilian National No-Gi champion, a Pan Am No-Gi champion, and a World No-Gi champion. He finished second in the 2017 ADCC tournament. He also recently competed against Benson Henderson at Polaris 6. So in terms of reasons to watch the preliminary card, those top two guys are the reason to watch.
That sounds good. It's a good little preview. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to this guy named Thor Skanky fighting.
Great name.
Yeah, I like him. But yeah, man, looking forward to this weekend of mixed martial arts, Jason. I think it's going to be a fun one. And we'll have plenty to talk about, both in terms of like what happens in Bellator. And also, of course, you mentioned the Nevada hearing. And I'm sure we'll have another event to preview.
Yeah, man, there's a lot of combat sports. You got PBC on Fox with Keith Thurman, who's a local fighter here in the Tampa Bay area. Actually, if you are a boxing fan, we'll have a show up later on this week on RadioInfluence.com, Big Fight Weekend, which will feature an interview with Keith Thurman. So plenty of MMA stuff going on. It's a big weekend here in Tampa, Daniel. It's Gasparilla weekend. So anyone who's listening that is from the Tampa Bay area, they know all about Gasparilla. It's basically, I guess the best way to put it is the city of Tampa is going to get drunk on Saturday. We celebrate pirates invading the city.
That's all, yeah. And the only way to do that is to get belligerently drunk.
Oh, damn, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to have to bring you in for Gasparilla 1 year, and you're going to go, this is awesome.
Yeah, you guys are crazy, and I can't wait to figure out what makes Florida so crazy.
Yeah, it's one of those events where you get down there, and once kind of everyone gets down there, you pretty much have no cell service.
That's nuts, yeah.
I think it's like a million people in line the streets. It's crazy. It's always a fun time. It's one of those events a year you get to see a lot of friends you necessarily don't see year round. So looking forward to that coming up here this weekend, but also definitely looking forward to Bellator 214 whatnot. Be sure to head over to the MMAReport.com to check out some various interviews that I've done that are not a part of the podcast. Also, be sure to subscribe to the MMA Report on YouTube, as well as we have content up there. And of course, always be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. Give us a rating and review. We really appreciate all of those 5-star ratings. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast, which comes out every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
This is a Rush the Field quick fix on Radio Influence.
So would you say that this is like the first step in the combine process? Because you get a lot of these kids that are going to come to the combine, and the NFL coaches, they're going to put them through all these drills and stuff. But here we are before the combine, months before the combine, and they're getting this opportunity to work with these NFL coaches. So would you say that this is the pre-combine combine almost?
It's the first step. Actually, last week at the East-West, and certainly this week, is the first step into the scouting process of, the draft process, I should say. Obviously, for the teams that whose seasons are done, this is the first entry with the coaches, the NFL coaches, who've not looked at college players on film during the season. This is their first opportunity to start to look at these guys. It's different than the combine. As you mentioned, the combine is going to take place in the month. That's a completely different environment. This is a football environment. I think it's a useful environment but it's a different one because it's football. It's watching them in practice, seeing them compete. You can spend time with them in meetings, particularly for one of the two teams coaching them. You get a lot accomplished here from a football standpoint. The combine is more about the medical physicals. It's more about the interviews. It's more about the intangible part and getting the exact measurables for all of these players. So, listen, it's all part of getting to know these players a little more. The scouts that have scouted them for not only this year but the past couple of years are fully aware of all their background information. But in the modern-day world of scouting, it is about – it's not like when I was running it where the scouts pretty much ran the draft. Now the scouts gather a lot of information, get a lot of details on the players, get some evaluations, kind of set the table for the coaching staffs, in which the coaching staffs now become involved as the NFL season is winding down or basically over. And then now they become involved in looking not only at the current players on their team, the current crop of free agents, but now are starting to delve into the prospects. And you get to see good 80, 90 players here at the Senior Bowl. And it's a good way to start to get a good feel for them before we get ready for the combine here in about a month.
Rush the Field with Scott Seidenberg and Chris Leandry can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.